Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Well, prosecutors generally like to send a jury into the weekend with some powerful testimony to chew over. And it sure seems like the Manhattan DA's office managed to do exactly that with longtime Trump aide Hope Hicks. The law firm of Weissman and Katyal is standing by, and I'm guessing they have some thoughts. Plus, at a donor event last night, Donald Trump took another page out of the authoritarian playbook and compared the Biden administration to the Nazi Gestapo. I'll get Congressman Jamie Raskin's reaction when he joins me here in studio. And later, from campus protests to worries about their own economic trajectory, it's clear that Gen Z is going to be central to this campaign. NYU professor Scott Galloway is here for a conversation about this moment for young people in America. Okay, so my first interaction with some of Donald Trump's senior aides was back in November of 2016, just 2 days after the election. And it's still one of my clearest memories from that period of time. It was the day Trump visited the White House. You can see the picture there. He met with President Obama in the Oval Office. And while that was happening, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, took a walk with White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough around the grounds and around the inside of the West Wing. And as press secretary at the time, Josh Earnest, pointed out in the briefing room that day, the president-elect brought someone else along too that day.
The president-elect's spokeswoman, Ms. Hicks, was here. I had an opportunity to meet with her, while the president-elect was meeting with President Obama. You noted that she also had longer meetings with some other members of some of my colleagues in the communications team.
Well, I was the White House communications director at the time, and on that day in 2016, just 2 days after the election, I was one of the people that sat down with Hope Hicks when she visited with then-President-elect Trump. And of all the things she could have asked us about, and granted, it was 2 days after kind of a shocking outcome of an election, she had one major question. How do you get the president to approve every statement that goes out in his name? So we told her how we did things, and we told her if we need a statement to commemorate, say, National Pancake Day, the president doesn't have to approve it. Obviously, if it's a more significant one, he does, and he works with us on it. And her response was interesting. She said, Mr. Trump will want to approve everything. Made clear to me that when it came to all things PR, her boss was the definition of a micromanager. Well, fast forward to Friday, and that's exactly how Hope Hicks portrayed Trump when she testified against him in a Manhattan courtroom. Her testimony revealed that he's obsessed and controlling when it comes to his media coverage. In fact, she testified that when she began working for Trump in 2015, during his first campaign, the media team consisted of only the two of them. She said, quote, it was just me and Mr. Trump, who's better than anybody at communications and branding. We're all just following his lead. He was very involved. Everyone who works there in some sense reports to Mr. Trump. It's a very big and successful company, but it's really run like a small family business. With all of that said, I mean, here's the takeaway. Trump was intimately involved in the minutiae of his 2016 presidential campaign, all of the statements, everything. So if he was aware of the small things, how could he not be aware of the big things? I mean, at one point, Hicks painted a vivid picture of the panic inside the Trump campaign after the infamous Access Hollywood tape was released and the attempts at damage control that followed. She said, quote, I had a good sense to believe this was going to be a massive story and that it was going to dominate the news cycle for the next several days. And that, quote, this was a damaging development. I mean, first of all, no kidding. Did anyone on the planet who saw that tape not recognize this was going to dominate news coverage and be extremely damaging? But that aside, what's even more damning was her testimony about a conversation she had with Trump once the Stormy Daniels story went public in 2018. Hicks testified that Trump told her that Michael Cohen had paid off Daniels without his direction or knowledge. But Hicks doubted Trump's cover story. She said, quote, that would be out of character for Michael. Hicks also said, quote, I think Mr. Trump's opinion was it was better to be dealing with it, the Stormy Daniels story. Now said that it would have been bad to have that story come out before the 2020 election. Look, we don't necessarily know what prompted her to break down in tears as she spoke about her former boss on the stand on Friday. But we do know her testimony was damning. She admitted the payoff was related to the campaign. She admitted that Trump knew about the payoff scheme. And without having to call her former boss a liar, she admitted that she thought the story he told her about Cohen doing it all on his own wasn't true. In the words of Hope Hicks, we were all just following his lead. Joining me now is Ashley Parker. She's a senior national political correspondent at The Washington Post. Andrew Weissman is former general counsel at the FBI. And Neil Katyal is the former acting U.S. Solicitor General. So I want to get into the Hope Hicks of it all. But I want to start, Andrew, with you, because you said that her testimony was devastating to Trump's case. Why?
So I think you outlined it very well, which is sort of you really have to think about where is this case going to be at the time of summation. And what she gives is really direct evidence from Donald Trump's mouth that he was aware of the hush money scheme with respect to Stormy Daniels. That was a hole in the case until she testified, because if you recall, until she testified, there was a lot of talk about how Donald Trump didn't sign the agreement between Stormy Daniels and essentially Michael Cohen, that there were four signature lines, but only three were signed. Donald Trump didn't sign. And so there was this issue of, did Michael Cohen do this on his own? And Donald Trump never knew. Well, she basically made it clear, of course he knew, and she has a direct statement from him, as well as you pointed out, her concern that, you know, there's no way Michael wouldn't have told him, because he would have wanted credit. And he's also not the kind of guy who would have done this on his own. Notably, what she didn't say is that Donald Trump, when he learned of this, was like, oh my God, what did you do? In fact, he said it was in his interest to do that. Finally, we're going to see this week the sort of the end result of what she's saying, which is that he reimbursed that $130,000. And I just want to make it very clear, he is on record in a civil case saying, I reimbursed Michael Cohen for those hush money payments. So this remains in the case is something that is on paper. So you really can see the end of this case coming up fast and furious. With the DA just closing it out on the actual reimbursement scheme, which is something that cannot really be denied credibly by Donald Trump's team.
All right. So Andrew kicked off on kind of the legal why. Now, Ashley, you covered the Trump team. You know them well. You wrote a great piece about Hope Hicks, where she was a central piece and person in it, where you wrote Hicks's reemergence at the criminal trial of her former boss is another grim reminder of Trump's force field, the seemingly inexorable pull he exerts, intentional or not, over nearly everyone who enters his world. You also say that since she testified to Congress about the January 6th attack, she hasn't spoken to him. There's a lot of speculation out there about why she cried on the stand. You know her, you know the team. Why do you think she did? She hasn't talked to him since January 6th. Since she testified, I should say.
Yeah, that's right. So a little context, right? Hope Hicks works, the way she ends up on his presidential campaign is she works for the Trump Organization. She knows his children. She knows him. He asks her to be one of the first staffers on his campaign. It's sort of so far-fetched. The idea that she would be on a presidential campaign is so far-fetched that when he asks, she thinks he's talking about a marketing campaign for one of his golf courses, right? She sort of occupies this role as almost a daughter. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of warmth and affection between the two of them. And when I was covering in the Trump White House, I was struck by, as has been reported, there were a lot of leaks in the media because there were these warring factions.
Within the White House,
there were warring factions. And a lot of people, you know, were leaking because they didn't like what the president was doing on their trade agenda or on this issue or that. And when Hope would deal with the media, when she got upset, she was non-ideological. She truly came through that she was upset because she thought the stories were hurting Mr. Trump, as she would call him, or President Trump, both politically and personally. So again, she really cared about him, right? So then she testifies before January 6th. She is compelled to testify. But that adds, I don't want to say a full rupture, but a cooling of their relationship, because my reporting showed that Ivanka, the president's daughter, was furious with Hope for text messages that came out that Hope had sent that day, sort of saying, the president is destroying everything we worked for. The only job we're going to be able to get is on a local Proud Boys chapter. Mm-hmm. And Trump himself thought she had gone too far. But in talking to people, they said, look, look, there's real warmth, there's real affection. She doesn't want to be doing this. She's angry, she's frustrated that she's being called again. She thinks it's a waste of time and money. So again, with all of that reporting, then a little bit as a viewer reading the tea leaf, she started crying when she, I believe, was she was sort of asked, you know, the Trumps offered you this ticket to this world. They're responsible for your job. And I think it was just truly an emotional moment for her, because it is an incredibly complicated relationship. She didn't want to be there. She didn't want to be answering those questions. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want her to be there. And he didn't want to be listening to what she had to say. And I think it was very uncomfortable for her to answer honestly with him, what, 6, 10 feet away.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, given their history, as you just outlined, and people can read Ashley Zecklin's story to learn more. Neil, you've obviously argued many cases in front of juries. How does a jury digest someone like Kopics? It's been laid out. She's close to the person who's the defendant. She gets emotional on the stand. How do they digest that? And what's the goal in that case of the prosecution?
So I'd say, John, the first kind of just big picture point is just how sordid this trial is. I mean, this trial is running through all of Trump's greatest hits, like Access Hollywood tape, the porn star he paid off. I mean, you can understand why his family isn't eager to be there in the courtroom. And I think the jury's probably not eager to be there either. And you can see Trump's defense emerging while the prosecution's building its case, which is they're taking pot shots at the witnesses and their credibility. Mm. They've already been attacking Michael Cohen before he's even shown up to testify. But at the end of the day, the really hard question is going to be, look, Trump's lawyer, Cohen, like took out a home equity loan on his house with his paid for this with his own money and then got it reimbursed by Trump as a business expense. And, mm-hmm. you know, and that was grossed up by Trump to avoid tax and the like. How could that possibly be Michael Cohen's own idea with no involvement or knowledge by Trump? So I think that's really what the jury's going to focus on.
Yeah.
And we saw, I think, today with the Hicks testimony, another possible defense, which is, look, yes, Trump knew something about these payments, but he was worried about protecting Melania. He was worried about, you know, the story coming out. That will have two big problems. One, Trump doesn't appear to have worried about Melania very much throughout, you know, his lifetime. And second, that he really appears, according to the testimony, to just want the catch and kill operation to take it through the election. He wasn't as worried about Melania or anyone else finding out about afterwards once he was president. He just wanted to keep it from the American people. And that's where Hicks was so devastating. I mean, she testified that when the Access Hollywood tape came out, everything changed and everyone was terrified. And so the catch and kill operation was part of trying to protect their candidate from the public.
So much we didn't know in the moment is what I keep coming back to. Andrew, and this is very consistent with what Hope said. I mean, you described Michael Cohen as a, quote, dog with a pheasant in his mouth, which actually made me laugh when I read that. Basically, someone who wants to show his boss what he did. I mean, how compelling and important is that component of his character? How does that link to what you expect his testimony to be like when he finally takes the stand?
Well, the jury is going to be asked, what possible reason would there be for Michael Cohen to have kept this to himself? And I think there's sort of two answers. One is, of course, he wouldn't, because he would want to get credit for this. In other words, there's nothing to hide here. There's only something to make him look good. In fact, you see from Hope Hicks that Donald Trump's reaction was, thank God Michael Cohen did this, because it would have been really bad for us if it came out before the election. I mean, she has that statement. That's how she ends her direct testimony on Friday. It was devastating. And the second is all of these pot shots that Neil refers to that have been taken with respect to Michael Cohen about his character is something that the DA isn't going to be hiding from. He's going to say, Exactly. You think this guy is charitable? Everything that you are hearing is that he wouldn't be doing this on his own and out of the goodness of his heart. So they're going to sort of flip the script on that issue, saying everything you've heard about what he's like as a person is why he would, of course, have gotten Donald Trump to approve. And finally, by the way, there are going to be telephone records that show that Michael Cohen, at the time of creating the vehicle used to pay back Stormy Daniels, is on phone calls with Donald Trump. just the same day. So the phone records themselves are going to be, I think, another piece, another nail in the DA's coffin that will be, you're going to hear a lot more about as the case closes.
Well, the trial reconvenes tomorrow morning. Ashley Parker, everybody read her story where she talks about Hope Hicks. She knows the Trump world so well. Thank you for joining us. Andrew Weissman, Neil Katyal, a huge pleasure as always. Thank you guys so much. And coming up, the one phrase from one prosecutor in Trump's criminal trial that I can't stop thinking about. And later, Congressman Jamie Raskin is here with reaction to leaked comments from the former president at a donor event just last night, comparing the Biden administration to the Nazi secret police, obviously. We're just getting started today, and we'll be
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Right back. Well, this week, Donald Trump's legal world and political world once again crashed into each other at full speed. And in some ways, the line between those two worlds has never been blurrier. He's a defendant one day, he's a candidate another, and on we go. But in the midst of this crazy mess we're all in the middle of and living through of trial days and bonkers campaign rallies and more trial days, we're watching something pretty important play out. Because right now, the defendant's strategy is showing up a whole lot about the showing us a whole lot about the candidate's strategy and also about his state of mind. Think about it this way. One of the big issues in this criminal trial in New York is the former president's gag order. Earlier in the week, he was fined for repeated violations, and the judge actually threatened him with jail time. That was obviously significant, but it didn't get him to stop. He kept going, kept threatening, kept attacking, because to him, that's kind of all he's got right now. So the judge held a second hearing on the gag order later in the week, and something one of the prosecutors said during those arguments really stuck out to me. He said Trump was creating, quote, an air of menace over the trial with his persistent and escalating rhetoric. An air of menace. Look, prosecutors choose their words very carefully. They think about them a lot. And that phrase really captures what he's trying to do, right? Threaten the judge, threaten the jury, threaten the witnesses. Rather than defend himself on the facts, he's calling the entire system into question, as if to say, it's all rigged. I'm the victim here. And by the way, there's going to be chaos if I lose. And what's so striking to me is that the air of menace that prosecutors spoke about in the courtroom in Lower Manhattan this week feels awfully similar to the air of menace that Donald Trump is trying to create over the entire country right now. While the defendant was in court this week, Time magazine released a set of lengthy interviews with the candidate. And there was basically menace on every page of that interview. We're going to talk about some of the truly alarming things he said about abortion and immigration and lots of other issues. But there was also a flashing red warning sign in that interview. Something that, as we say time and time again about stuff like this, would be blaring front news at any other time in political history. During the interview, Trump was asked about the prospect of political violence around the election. Here's what he said, quote, I think we're going to win. And if we don't win, you know, it depends. It always depends on the fairness of an election. Not I denounce all political violence, not under no circumstances should there be violence. He said, it depends. And then in a separate interview this week with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, he said this, quote, if everything's honest, I'd gladly accept the results. If it's not, you have to fight for the right of the country. You have to fight for the right of the country. I mean, talk about an air of menace. So yes, in both the trial and the campaign, there should be real concern around what he's trying to do, around the atmosphere of fear and intimidation he's trying to create. But we should also be really clear about what it tells us. Because defendants who think they're innocent don't attack the jury or the judge or other members of the judiciary involved with their case, typically. And candidates who are confident about their message don't say violence might be necessary if they lose. Congressman Jamie Raskin has seen this movie before when it comes to Donald Trump. He's standing by here in studio, and he joins me next. We say this pretty much every week, but there is a lot going on right now. There's way too much to process and sift through every single day, even for those of us who literally do this for a living. But with exactly 6 months to Election Day, one of the most important things we have to keep our eye on is what exactly Donald Trump would do if he gets back to the White House. And we don't have to talk about specifics here. Luckily, he's making that very, very easy for us. In an interview with Time Magazine released this week, Donald Trump laid it all out. He'd work to deport more than 11 million people from the country and use the National Guard to do it. He'd let red states monitor women's pregnancies, you're hearing me correctly, and prosecute those who violate abortion bans. He'd be willing to fire a U.S. attorney who refused to carry out his order to prosecute someone. He's weighing pardons for every one of his supporters accused of attacking the Capitol on January 6th. There's much more. And he'd staff his administration entirely with people who back his false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. At the end of the interview, the reporter asked him if he understood why Americans might take issue with the dictatorship he's promising. His response, I think a lot of people like it. I'm not sure about that. And what do authoritarians and dictators do to their opponents? Well, they usually project, which is why yesterday at a private donor event, Trump compared the Biden administration to the Gestapo. Joining me now is Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. So let me just start there where I ended, because when you hear Donald Trump, I know we get a little numb to this, but we can't compare the Biden administration to the Gestapo. What is your reaction to that?
Every accusation is a confession, essentially, of purpose. And we've never had presidential candidates, much less presidents, talk like that before about the other party in America. There's been a very strong degree of civility at that level. And so it telegraphs some very dark intentions on his part.
It's what dictators do, which is so important for people to remember. I want to just go back to the thing I also ended on there, which is that the final summary of this article, which was very lengthy. I mean, it was like an 83-minute interview where he said a lot of things. He said about the his talk of dictatorship, a lot of people like it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's right about that in the sense that dictators, whether Pinochet in Chile or Mussolini or, you know, the most horrible specimens from the 20th century have always had their supporters. It doesn't last long because most people want to lead a life of democracy and security and freedom and self-government. But those kinds of opportunists and demagogues have always been able to fool some significant part of the population for a certain period of time. And the founders of America knew that. Alexander Hamilton, in the very first Federalist paper, warned of demagogues who would whip up a mob frenzy based on negative emotions instead of using government as an instrument for the common good to make things better for people. So at this point, Americans are forewarned. If you look at the things he's talking about doing, mass roundups and incarceration and deportations from the country, crackdown on women in red states on abortion, banning women from going from red states to blue states to get reproductive health care, freeing the so-called January 6 hostages, who are a majority of whom people who've pled guilty to violently assaulting our police officers. That is an authoritarian program. I mean, that's right out of the authoritarian playbook of the Mussolini and beyond.
No question about it. And some who are still in off and still around the country, dictators right now. He also said, and what strikes me time and time again, is that we've seen this movie before. You have led investigations into this movie we've seen. And when he said, I think we're going to win, and if we don't win, you know, it depends. It always depends on the fairness of an election. He said that in response to a question about the potential for political violence.
Yeah. which is a hallmark of fascist and authoritarian political parties. But look, now none of the Republicans will commit to stand by the results of the 2024 election. They won't even stand by the results of the 2020 election when 60 different federal and state court decisions rejected every claim of election fraud and corruption that Donald Trump brought forward. And still they're saying it was a stolen election. There is zero evidence of that. You cannot make a remotely plausible case for it. So they're living in an alternate reality, and that's how authoritarianism works.
And they're still, to your point, not willing to commit to abiding by the outcome in 2024. There was a little bit of like a VP stakes race out there with a lot of people this morning on Sunday morning shows answering versions of this question. I want to play you something that Tim Scott said in an exchange with Kristen Welker and get your thoughts on it.
Well, Senator, will you commit to accepting the election results of 2024? Bottom line.
Well, at the end of the day, the 47th president of the United States will be President Donald Trump. And I'm excited to give back to low inflation, low unemployment.
Wait, Senator, yes or no? Yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024 no matter who wins?
That is my statement.
That is my statement. It's not a hard question, I think we should acknowledge. Clearly, that is what Trump wants him to say. He wants to be on his VP list. But how concerned should we be about that becoming, as you alluded to earlier, the common response?
I mean, it's a dramatic departure from American history when all of the major presidential candidates have agreed to abide by the outcome, even when there are real questions, like in 2000 in Bush versus Gore. Vice President Gore actually had a lead in the popular vote. There were real questions about what was taking place in Florida, and yet he stood down in the interests of constitutional continuity. And now we've got politicians who will not even abide by a certifiably legal election outcome because they say, well, Donald Trump is going to be the 47th president, end of the day, not end of the election, but end of the day. And we know what other kinds of events they might have planned for that day.
Which is such an important thing for people to remember and be clear about. Hope Hicks, we've been talking a little bit this morning or this afternoon about Hope Hicks' testimony and the significance of that. You were a member of the January 6th committee, of course, when she testified before the January 6th committee. What did you make of the testimony on Friday, the significance of it or not significance? What's your view?
Well, the best way of understanding that trial taking place in New York is that it's part of Trump's determination to essentially predetermine the outcome of an election, not by advancing a program and going out and knocking on doors and campaigning, but rather by manipulating public opinion. And so there it was all about paying off hush money to a former mistress to keep it out of the news and sweep everything under the rug. But the problem was they were messy in terms of leaving a money trail behind. And he described it as legal expenses when he reimbursed Michael Cohen for the money that was going to Stormy Daniels. And that made it an illegal campaign expenditure. And they were cooking the books from the standpoint of state law. So her testimony to me reinforced that there was a mad scramble within the Trump campaign to deal with the problem of the Access Hollywood tape and Donald Trump bragging about his misogynistic sexual assaults on women in different places. And so they couldn't afford to have another one of these outbursts.
They knew. He knew that it was going to be an impact, which is striking to me. Congressman Jamie Raskin, thank you always for your clarity of explaining difficult issues and bringing us all back to the what's at stake here. I appreciate you joining me today. Coming up, someone I've been looking forward to talking to for a very long time, and is a favorite of my mother's as well, NYU Professor Scott Galloway joins me live on why he thinks young people have every reason to be enraged right now. We'll also talk about his brand new book that's being described as a, quote, must-have guide to optimizing your life for wealth and success.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Conversation is coming up next. So you may have seen this by now, but my next guest went viral recently for something he said about the state of the country right now for younger Americans.
I think it all ties into what we're talking about on campuses. For the first time in our nation's history, a 30-year-old man or woman isn't doing as well as his or her parents were at 30. That is the social compact breaking down. Young people have every reason to be enraged, and every issue they see, they look up, they get angry, and they see someone doing better than them, and then every day it is speedballed in their face that they are failing, that they are not doing as well as everyone around them. We have lost the script. Our kids are more anxious and more depressed and more obese and more addicted. And we have made a purposeful decision to let this happen by ensuring the people around this table stay wealthy at the cost of young people.
At the cost of young people. I mean, so much so that my mother, who's a family therapist, immediately bought his book and told me I need to buy his book as well. That was professor and entrepreneur Scott Galloway laying out the economic realities for so many young Americans. And yes, as the last few weeks have shown us, there are so many serious issues underscoring that anger, including, as we've seen on some college campuses, the impact of the war between Israel and Hamas on the people of Gaza, anti-Semitism on some campuses. But there is no question the state of the economy and America's economic future remains front and center, including for young people. In fact, the recent Harvard Youth Poll released last month, in that poll, pollsters asked about 2,000 Americans between the ages of 18 and 29, a key voting block, an open-ended question about which national issue concerned them most. And I was kind of surprised, frankly, by the outcome. Because as you can see, the economy is the number one issue right now, for them right now. I bet you my next guest is not surprised. Scott Galloway joins me now. He's a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. And his new book, The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security, is out now. And obviously, I need to get you on set so you can sign a book for my mom. But we'll wait for that. So let me just start, Scott, with, you know, we've seen, of course, some disruptions on college commencements, even this weekend, including at Michigan. That's after the campus protests at places like Columbia and Michigan were broken up just a few days ago. They're not monolithic, but they think is something is so important for people to understand. But just, you've talked about this a fair amount, which has been interesting to me. Describe to me what you think underlies some of the anger we're seeing on campuses. We are seeing, of course, anger about what's happening in Gaza. What else is missing, in your view, from the conversation right now?
Well, first off, good to be with you, and thanks for the kind words at the opening. Look, the cost to buy a house has gone from $290,000 to $410,000 in the last 4 years, and interest rates have gone from 2.5% to 7.5%. So the average mortgage payment for an entry-level home has gone from $1,100 to $2,200. So the American dream is now out of the reach of two-thirds of Americans. In addition, college costs have absolutely skyrocketed. Me and my colleagues wake up every morning and ask ourselves the same question: how do we increase our compensation while decreasing our accountability? And we found the ultimate strategy, and that is to create artificial scarcity. There's no reason Harvard, with $52 billion in funds in their endowment, needs to sequester 95% of their applicants and let in a freshman class the size or the number of a good Starbucks. We totally sequester housing permits. So their costs have skyrocketed. The costs for the American life have skyrocketed. Their purchasing power has come down. And it pours incendiary on everything. And I'm not suggesting these aren't righteous movements, but it turns everything from a minor abrasion into an opportunistic infection, because the atmospherics are, I don't have the opportunity you did, and I'm enraged.
We've seen, again, as I mentioned, I think it's so important for people to understand these are not monolithic protests. The students and what they feel and their knowledge is not monolithic either. There are some campuses like Brown and Northwestern, Vassar, who have come to some form of diplomatic resolutions of sorts. I mean, they involve divestment in some cases or commitment to discuss divestment. Is there a lesson or is there a path that any university has taken that you think is a good model for others?
It's a really important point, Jim, because the reality is if you look at the actual numbers, look at Columbia, which was sort of a flashpoint. The number of students arrested or even at the protests is typically less than 1% of the student body. And I would argue the vast majority of these protests have been civil and peaceful protests. But that's not interesting for media or for TikTok. So it's the unfortunate stuff that gets broadcast. I was at NYU last week and it felt pretty normal. At Columbia, an Israeli girl was elected president of the university. So, you know, there's people have compared this to 1968. There's not nearly the intensity or the number of people involved in these protests as there were then. I think a lot of Jewish people are worried that this has greater echoes of 1938, where there seems to be at my alma mater, UCLA, I can't tell you just how horrified I was to see thoughtful students or supposedly thoughtful students passing out wristbands to non-Jews and then not allowing anyone without a wristband, i.e. Jews, restricting them from access to different buildings at UCLA. I would put forward, Jen, that if that was happening to any other special interest group, the response would have been much swifter and much harsher. So yes, there's a bit of a misleading perception around how intense these protests are. I think the majority of them have been peaceful. But I think the scary thing here is there a double standard? If I went into the plaza of any of these universities with a white hood and a Confederate flag and started saying, burn the gays or lynch the blacks, I don't think I'd ever work in academia again. And I think if I incited anything around a disturbance or restricted students of any other special interest group to facilities on campus, I think they'd call in the National Guard. So I think it's smaller than people think, but I think some of the themes are very disturbing here.
No question. It's important to note, of course, there are a population of students who are outraged, understandably, about what's happening in Gaza. It also is true that if you are screaming from the river to the sea and you're trying to represent an oppressed body of people, you're oppressing another. And that's something I think also is occurring in some cases. Let me ask you about your book, which is amazing and people should purchase. It's chock full of incredibly important advice and lessons, I will say. I love what you say about getting exercise. It's by far the most common observable characteristic among high-performing people. It's mental health to me. That's how I see it. You wrote about taking risks as an entrepreneur. You also write this, which I think is so insightful. Everything meaningful in life is about others, your ability to support and love others, and your willingness to let them love you. Nothing profound is achieved in isolation. I mean, you're a successful guy. What I read that as is saying, there's so much more than wealth. Wealth is defined by a range of things. What do you want people to take away?
I could have been more successful if I had been a little smarter about making, similar to when you invest small amounts as a young person and it compounds, those small investments you make in other people, thinking about them when a job opportunity comes up, checking in, running to them when they're not feeling well, being generous, articulating your emotions. Wealth is a full person project. I think if I'd made more of those little investments, I would have been a lot more successful. And the other lesson I think is that money and financial security is the means. The ends is having an absence from anxiety and more time so you can focus on what every study says is the key to happiness. And that is the number of deep and meaningful relationships you have. Money is the means. The ends are deep, loving relationships. And money, unfortunately, in a capitalist society, is a requisite for having an absence from stress such that you can focus what is important in your life. Money is the ink in your pen. It can write different chapters. It can make certain chapters burn brighter, but it's not your story. Your story is deep and meaningful relationships.
Such an important note. You're not rolling in money like Scrooge McDuck at the end of your life. First of all, you're thinking about your relationships. I appreciate you, Scott Galloway, joining me. And congratulations on your excellent book. Thanks for being with me this afternoon. And I'll share my thoughts on Trump's go-to answer on abortion and the ace up the GOP sleeve to take their restrictions national. We'll be right back. Six months out from the election, and Donald Trump seems to have settled on his favorite abortion talking point. Basically, leave it up to the states. But if you take just one second to dig past the surface of that completely evasive non-answer, you can already see the horrifying reality on the ground in states with strict abortion restrictions, where, by the way, it has been entirely left up to them, as he suggested. In Texas, one woman miscarried in a hospital's lobby restroom as front desk staff refused to check her in. In North Carolina, a woman gave birth in a car after an emergency room couldn't offer an ultrasound. The baby later died. In Florida this week, there were a number of stories of women who needed care who were rushed to providers before the state's new six-week ban was enacted. And in Idaho, state officials have argued that despite a federal law that mandates that pregnant women receive stabilizing care in emergency rooms that receive federal funds, a woman may only receive an emergency abortion in that state if it is safe to, if it is to save the life of the mother, not to preserve her health. That's what they argue. Let that sink in for a moment. The state of Idaho is arguing against a federal law that guarantees a standard of care for pregnant women, a standard of care that they get the care they need in these rare emergency situations. And the conservative majority in the Supreme Court is seriously considering siding with Idaho. Here's the thing. Donald Trump seems to be perfectly fine with all of it, even supportive of this approach. Remember, he has said these state laws are, quote, working very brilliantly. And as we were just discussing, we found out this week that he would be fine with Republican states doing more to restrict reproductive freedoms. In an interview with Time magazine, I was discussing with Congressman Jamie Raskin earlier, when he was asked about state laws that could monitor women's pregnancies, he replied, quote, I think they might do that. And when asked whether he would be comfortable with states prosecuting women who had illegal abortions, he said, quote, it's irrelevant whether I'm comfortable or not. The states are going to make those decisions. At 3:27 a.m. this morning, strangely, Trump reiterated his position in a post on Truth Social, saying, quote, it is all working. We'll never go back to the federal government, and our country will soon start uniting on this long, contentious issue. It's all working? I mean, it's not working for the majority of women, because Trump is promoting is a cruel patchwork of anti-abortion measures, where women in a growing number of states are dependent on the whims of the courts and the whims of the state legislatures to determine what rights they will have about their own bodies. And while he says it will never go back to the federal government, Trump has been noticeably evasive when pressed on the specifics of what he would do on a federal level if he gets reelected. And that is worth paying attention to. Because the anti-abortion movement surrounding Trump believes that they have an ace up their sleeve. In that same interview with Time magazine, Trump declined to give his position on the right-wing attempt to ban the abortion drug mifepristone, as well as his view on reviving a long-dormant federal law known as the Comstock Act. And this is important. The Comstock Act is a dormant 1873 anti-obscenity law that bans the mailing of obscene material. It also bans the mailing of materials used for abortion. It has become a core piece of the anti-abortion movement's attempt to federally ban mailing drugs used for abortion. And even more concerning, the movement has sought to use this law as a means to restrict abortion without requiring any action from Congress or any action from courts. I mean, the fear is that a second Trump administration would revive this zombie law as a means of restricting abortion nationally without even a vote. Trump has been silent on this, but his allies have not, and that's pretty telling. Project 2025, a plan for the next conservative presidency put together by Trump, acolytes and top conservative organizations, it's all online, by the way, calls for a, quote, campaign to enforce the criminal prohibitions of the Comstock Act against providers and distributors of abortion pills. And even one of Trump's lawyers, who is also the architect of the Texas abortion law, said, quote, we don't need a federal ban when we have the Comstock on. We have Comstock on the books. That's pretty telling. As always with Trump, it's important to read the fine print because he and his allies are telling us exactly what they plan to do. I've got one more thing to tell you about before we go today, and we're back after a quick break. That does it for me today, but we're already getting ready for a huge show tomorrow night with Donald Trump's trial set to resume tomorrow morning in Manhattan. Former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, will join me on set. And so will Trump's former White House Press Secretary, Stephanie Grisham. She'll also join me on the show. And another quick reminder that my brand new book, I Can't Believe This, Say More, comes out this Tuesday. I'll be visiting a lot of different cities on my book tours over the next few weeks for some great conversations with some people you will definitely recognize, including Lawrence O'Donnell at the 92nd Street Y on Wednesday and many, many others. We'll put all of the info up on our social media pages, and I hope to see lots of you out on the road. In the meantime, we'll see you tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.